From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll speak with two election clerks about how they're preparing for the November election and how they're combating misinformation. Then we'll meet Wisconsin's 77th Alice in Dairyland and learn how she helps promote the state's agriculture industry.
Whether you're an eighth generation growing up on a farm or you have never milked a cow in your life, like, you can get involved in agriculture at any age, and I hope that I stand as a testament to that.
Plus, we'll visit the MKE Outdoor-Indoor Exchange to learn about their secondhand business model.
And my thing right now on a whole, like, kind of vision is I'm cleaning up the gear industry. I'm cleaning up the perimeter of the gear industry. There's a lot of overflow. There's a lot of excess. There's a lot of overproduction.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. In 2020, former President Donald Trump falsely claimed the election was stolen for President Joe Biden. Since then, elections and the officials who run them have faced more skepticism and distrust. WUWM sent a survey to municipal clerks across Wisconsin who run elections. We heard back from 180 of them, telling us about the issues they're facing ahead of this year's presidential election and about what they wish people understood about elections. Two of those clerks are here to share their experiences. They're Sandy Kulik, village clerk of Hales Corners, and Catherine Ruskey, clerk in the city of Oak Creek. Thank you both so much for joining me.
You're welcome.
Now, in Wisconsin, elections administration is really decentralized. It's run at the local level by hundreds of municipal and county clerks like yourselves. How long have you been doing this work, and what keeps you coming back?
I have been a city clerk in Oak Creek since 2012. I love election administration. It's a project management-based job. And we actually see a completion of a project every single election. There's, you know, a positive 100% done.
I've been in government for 24 years. I was the assistant clerk in the city of Lake Geneva during the 2008 Chad debate, in and out of it. Since then, I've been with Hales Corners for the last 9 years.
Now, of course, listeners may know, but you certainly do, there have been 3 elections in Wisconsin this year, but the big one is coming up in about a month. What are the most significant challenges you're facing ahead of the presidential election?
The biggest confusion is the mass mailers that are sent out by firms all across the country that have my name on them. And residents are concerned. Typically, the ones that come in are the elderly residents or the potentially ESL, English language challenged voters. That believe I've unregistered them, and they're very confused and very angry most of the time, or they're convinced something is wrong because it has my name on it. That has been a recent uptick of that since 2020. It didn't used to always be like that.
Now, when you're saying mailers, are these kind of like flyers that are telling people to register? What are these?
My personal favorite is the one that says official government document, do not throw out, and it's from some company out of Texas.
Just like a piece of mail?
Nope. It's a giant mailer that looks like the size of an absentee ballot. Inside of it is a partially pre-filled out voter registration form or an absentee form, one of the two, or sometimes both. So,
is this something you're also experiencing?
Yeah, Sandy's right on. We have probably 22,000 registered voters in our municipality, and these are voters that have been registered for 10 years, 15, 30 years. And really, it does cause confusion on the voter. I encourage voter participation. It's what our jobs, the core of our job, is to ensure that if you are eligible to vote in the state of Wisconsin, that we get you registered and enable your right to vote. However, this does cause a lot of confusion for the voters. It's an uptick in phone calls, people coming into City Hall. There's a lot of concern. And unfortunately, it perpetuates the mistrust and suspicion of how elections are managed. Wisconsin Election Commission has been very supportive in that they understand that these mailers don't come from our office. But the way that the mailer is printed, it has our return information on the envelope. So everyone in Oak Creek that receives the mailer, the return address is municipal clerk. So people will call and say, why am I not registered anymore? Oh, no, I've pulled you up. You're great in the system, but it does cause a lot of confusion.
Well, it seems like this is just adding a lot of confusion into a system that, as you mentioned, there is a lot of election skepticism. It's become really common since Donald Trump lost the presidential election in 2020, especially, and falsely claimed that it was stolen. Have you seen that distrust showing up in other ways besides these mailers, which are causing so much confusion?
At the polls. I don't know if you had that. I had several voters at the polls.
Yeah.
And they will come up pretty aggressively convinced there's something goofy. I listen to it for a while, and eventually they'll go somewhere, and I'm like, we're done here. You have to leave the polling site. And then they're mad at me. Only once I've actually had to call a police officer to remove someone from the polling site because of their behavior. They have ones that are convinced that boatloads of illegal immigrants are voting. None of these things, and again, Catherine's been at this longer than I have, but none of these things as a primary election clerk are happening. I shouldn't say none, but if it happens, it's got to be incredibly rare. We are checking, cross-checking, and tying out this information to three separate systems.
Yeah, I would further that one of our large issues that always happens close to a larger election is the changes for election administration itself, current legislation, changing of election laws or guidelines close to an election period, again, causes confusion for the voters. It causes confusion for election clerks.
Yeah, the constant changing of the rules, it's like quicksand. Yes, you can have a ballot box. No, you can't have a ballot box. I saw that coming and I just said no. I got enough things to juggle. We only have one polling site. I don't need a ballot box.
Now, you mentioned that you are not using drop boxes. Will you be using drop boxes, or are you currently?
Yes, the City of Oak Creek, we have one drop box that's located at City Hall. So obviously it's open to voters 24/7.
Okay.
Yeah, it's much larger situation than my one polling site. There's a lot more going on there, and I can certainly understand that.
Now, Sandy, you mentioned that you have had issues with people coming in asking questions, sometimes being belligerent. In some municipalities, poll workers are even going through de-escalation training to prepare them for, potentially tense situations on election day. What precautions do both of you have in place to make sure poll workers are safe on November 5th?
I have an easy one. I had the largest police officer I have. He's just huge. And he just happens to live at Hale's Quarters, and he's going to be standing at the door as a greeter. But I'm also having training. I did do the de-escalation training as well, and it's very good training. I will be having another training, I'm sure she is as well, before the election. All the poll workers come in again. And I would say, fortunately, it's a pretty rare thing. And I would say the majority of people are pretty good. It's a handful here and there throughout an 18-hour day that get like that. It's not every single voter.
Yeah, as Sandy stated, we have had an influx of security training, threat training, Homeland Security, Wisconsin Election Commission, an organization, CISA, it's Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency. I have six different polling locations. Additionally, I run a central count, and I can explain more about that, but that's where we process our absentee ballots. So essentially, I have seven different polling locations on Election Day. Later this week, I have CISA coming in, and they have kindly offered to run a threat assessment point of first entrance at all of my polling locations to ensure the safety of my voters and my poll workers. Now, in general, just with the heightened emotions around politics and Election Day and, misconceptions out there, I think it's really important that if there's an opportunity that's offered to me to ensure that our elections are safe, that I take advantage of that opportunity. So I work with our local police department quite a bit. I will train my poll workers. I will provide additional training to my chief inspectors.
This is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers, and I'm speaking right now with two election clerks from Wisconsin, Sandy Kulik from Hales Corners, and Catherine Ruskey from Oak Creek. Now, Catherine, as you mentioned, you do have a bit of a larger operation. Can you walk me through what happens with a ballot on Election Day in Oak Creek, both absentee ballots and ballots that were cast in person on Election Day?
Certainly. I think one of the misconceptions in our verbiage when we talk about absentee ballots, first and foremost, is that so there's the 2 weeks prior to the election. You can come in and vote early at my office, and that's absentee voting. So it's somewhat the same process, but it's not getting mailed to you. The other type of absentee is that you have the absentee ballot mailed to your address of choice, and you return it by mail, or you can drop it off back in my office. So all of those ballots that are considered early in-person or early absentee, those are processed at a central count location that's essentially another whole polling district for the city of Oak Creek. So the poll workers work in pairs. They work in teams. There's a lot of checks and balances that have happened with all of these ballots, these envelopes, before actual election day. We have to verify that that certificate envelope has all the required information to be accepted. And as those ballots come back in, they're checked for accuracy. If not, we try to reach the voter. We sometimes have to mail them back to them to make sure they're correct. So the poll workers at Central Count will review that information prior to opening any envelope. Then they go through a very strict, methodical, slow process to ensure that they are not missing anything on a ballot that should cause it to be rejected. And then those are processed all day long, and we start at 7 a.m. We open up the machines. We open up the polls just like we were out at a location. And typically for this election, it'll take us pretty near to 8 p.m. when the polls close to go through all those ballots, process of machines. We have to tabulate. We have to do everything like we would do at a polling location, absent the voter. Ballots are accepted at City Hall up until 8 p.m. on Election Day, much like the voters out at the polls. So that's our central count location. Observers are welcome. And then out at Election Day with those ballots, they are tabulated in the machine. The tabulation doesn't occur until we close the polls in that machine at 8 p.m. If you are in line waiting to vote at 8 p.m., the last person in line is allowed to vote. Machines are closed, and then they tabulate. And observers are also welcome to watch the closing of polls and the paperwork and that sort of thing.
The other interesting part that she touched on, too, before they even get there, we have to reconcile every recorded, received, return ballot to our poll book. So they're tied out in three different places. And before you even start, because your poll book is going to identify this is an absentee returned or issued, and it says that on the poll book. So that all matches. The envelopes have to match the total number of those things. And at the end of the day, that all of that has to still match the tabulation equipment. And when that comes back, we reconcile it. Then it goes out to the county, and they reconcile it. It's not one person that's looking at all of this paperwork. It's several people. So but there's lots of checks and balances.
I think there has been so much misinformation about elections, a lot of conspiracy theories, and one of those involved voting machines themselves. I think there's been a lot of misunderstanding about how they work exactly. How do voting machines actually work, and what happens if they break?
We have a backup. So we have a backup
sure.
machine, but there's barcoding around the outside. They're pre-tested. Ballots are a test deck, set sample, and I'm sure it's something you test them for all your wards, a pretest with an expected set of results. So we do a pretest to make sure that that functions correctly. If it doesn't, everything gets picked up, goes back to the county, and they do it again. Then by the time we get to the public test, which the public is welcome to come and view, it's tested again.
But after we do those tests, the machine is zeroed out. So we clear out all of our results. At the start of Election Day, the first, there's a configuration tape that prints, and then there is a zero result tape. And that tape, when that prints, will show you there are no votes, ballots in this machine. So everything on that tape, that's the first thing you do is verify the tape that there's no vote counts whatsoever in the machine. and then it sits. It actually takes a picture and takes an image of every single ballot that goes into the machine, all on a USB. When you close down the machine at the end of the night, that's when it tabulates. It takes a little bit, it'll tabulate, and it'll print out your entire results tape. And you can imagine if you have, in Central Count, I have 19 wards, and say I have 7,000, 8,000 absentee ballots, this isn't something that at 8:10 anybody would be gaining results from my municipality. It's going to take me a little while to reconcile and get that tape even rolled up and then recorded so that we can produce our results. And I think that's one, you know, there's a couple things that I wish voters really knew, but I wish they could view that absentee for a larger municipality and how long that takes to do that reconciliation. And, you know, I remember the days when I was in college and I remember working on a certain campaign and we were up all night and we didn't get results sometimes to the next day. That was the fun of it. You find out the next day who won. But now, you know, everybody wants that instant gratification, that who won, that who won. And then if they don't have that immediately, it's suspect. And so that's a bit frustrating on the clerk's part. You know, we go home. I know I in this election, I'll probably go home about 2 a.m. Yep. and get back to work at 6 a.m.
It's an 18 to 20 hour day. It's a long day. It's a very long day. And we're still doing it. I'm not even tired. It takes me a couple hours even after I get home to kind of dial that down.
Sure.
So
one of the misconceptions, I think, is that these machines are connected to the internet, which, of course, they aren't. But what are some of the other things you wish people understood about the election process?
There's only two pieces of my job that are like 170% of my attention, elections and budget. It is the one time the public can really see what we do and how hard we're working for them. And it's not personal. Zero is my favorite number. That means everything balances. And I just wish they understood that we take this very seriously. This is not some half attempt to monitor paper. It's not. So we all take it pretty seriously.
Yeah, and for me, I really feel that we are in a time of crisis of trust in elections. And I have put great thought into this for years on how do we get back to where we were. And I really think education, sharing the processes for voters to have an understanding of the mechanics of an election is so important. Times like these, us having this conversation is very helpful. I will have so many friends that come up to me and say, I don't believe it. I don't believe they're trustworthy. And I look at them and I think, well, you voted my municipality. And everyone says, well, not you. I trust you. I don't trust the process. I said, you understand that I create and manage that process. Like, I do that for our whole municipality. Yeah, but it's not you. It's everyone else out there. So how do we get past that? How do we get so that you know me? I'm similar to Sandy. We're all doing the same job. You know, not speaking on behalf of every clerk, but the clerks that I am associated with, I have so much respect for the work that they do. The poll workers, so much respect for what they do. Everyone is very dedicated to the process. What's changed, I think, is the suspicion that's come aloft that now we're dealing with. So I wish that voters would spend more time coming in. I know I have trained a lot of poll workers over the past year who came in saying, I don't believe it. I want to see it. And I guarantee you, every single poll worker that has worked their first election because they wanted a better understanding has come back to me and said, I had no idea. I had no idea. I now tell my friends. Now I have voters and residents and poll workers that have done that, that now are advocates for the process. So I think education and sharing the process from your trusted resources is the best thing that we can do right now leading into this election.
All right. Well, Catherine, Sandy, thank you both so much for taking the time out to speak with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Catherine Ruske is the municipal clerk in Oak Creek, and Sandy Kulik is the clerk in Hales Corners. You can find more takeaways from the survey of Wisconsin election administrators at WUWM.com.
And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll visit a local shop that considers itself a recyclery first and a gear store second. But first, we'll meet Wisconsin's Alice in Dairyland and learn how she's sharing her passion for agriculture with others in the state. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Did you know Wisconsin has agricultural royalty? Haley Heinzel was crowned as Wisconsin's 77th Alice in Dairyland earlier this summer. During her year-long tenure, she'll promote the state's agriculture industry and the ways it impacts our lives. She joins Lake Effect's Excret Nunez to share how she earned the title of Alice in Dairyland and what her job consists of.
For listeners who aren't familiar, can you tell me a little bit about what Alice in Dairyland is?
So I serve as Wisconsin's official agricultural ambassador for our state's $104.8 billion agriculture industry. I work for the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protections, doing things all the way from visiting agricultural events like the State Fair, County Fairs. I also do Farm Bureau meetings. I'm in classrooms doing some agricultural presentations. And you'll also hear me on the radio and see me on TV occasionally. Talking about agriculture.
Yeah, so just to clarify, as Alice in Dairyland, promoting dairy is only part of your job.
Absolutely.
Right?
So I like to say that there's a lot more than dairy here in America's Dairyland. We scope the entire agriculture industry from cattle to swine, corn, cranberries, Christmas trees, and everything in between. There is so much to learn and love here in Wisconsin's diverse agriculture industry.
Yeah, I think I read something about, like, even the gem on your crown is from Wisconsin or something like that.
So the crown jewel on my tiara is an amethyst, which is the state gemstone of Wisconsin. But I also have a couple citrines on there, which are also native to Wisconsin. And the tiara honors the mining history here in the state of Wisconsin. That's why we're called the Wisconsin Badgers.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, oh, that's, like, a lot of fun facts. Love that. So I know the process of becoming Alice is pretty rigorous. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a bit about what you did to become Alice in Dairyland?
Absolutely. They say it's one of the most difficult job interviews you'll have in your entire life. Thank goodness for that. It's all downhill from here.
Oh, my gosh.
But I started with an interview in January of this year at DATCAP office, and then I was announced as a top candidate of six women eligible for the role of becoming Alice, and that was in the host county of Door County this year. The host county rotates every year, so I lucked out. I was in Door County. And then throughout the next few months, I was learning all about what it means to be an ambassador for agriculture, how to best represent our program partners for the Alice in Dairyland program, and also, you know, do you want the job? And we also did some weekly assignments, kind of proving that we could do the role. So if it was an example social media post or a video, kind of showing all, Alice does a lot of different things. So it's kind of proving that you could be in the role of Alice. And then in May, we went back to the host county, in Door County, for a three-day partially public job interview. So there were some portions that were open to the public to view where we were giving speeches. There were some opportunities to be on the radio and TV. And we also did six industry tours learning more about agriculture, specifically in Door County. And then at the end of that process, Alice is finally selected. And I was lucky enough that it was me this year.
Wow. So you said you start in January. Like, what's going on for all of those months up until May?
Yeah, so I was actually in school at the time. I just graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in May. So during that whole process of becoming Alice, where I was doing those weekly lessons, learning about being Alice and doing those assignments, I was also trying to graduate college. I was working on an internship. I had an on-campus job. So I had quite a few things going on in between January and May. But it was a lot of fun, and I definitely if you're looking to become Alice, anyone can become Alice over the age of 21. You just need 3 years of experience in the agricultural communications field. Those applications will be going out in January of this year. I highly recommend it. Anybody becomes a better person on the other side of running for Alice.
And so I know that you were the only one out of six candidates who didn't grow up on a farm. You're mm-hmm. from Oconomowoc, urban part of Oconomowoc, which I think speaks to you don't need to come from an agriculture upbringing to work within the ag industry. So what personally draws you to do this kind of work?
I was always really curious about where my food came from. And of course, I loved farm animals, cows and horses and all of that. And growing up, I really always wondered like where the farmers were in my community. I had never met one until I got to high school. And it was realizing that it wasn't that farmers weren't out there. It was just that I didn't recognize them or see them. There are neighbors, there are community members, even here in Milwaukee. There are still people doing urban agriculture with hydroponics. Like there are farmers and food producers everywhere. And I joined the FFA organization in high school. And in 2018, I milked a cow for the very first time, which is what really set me on that path towards continuing to learn everything I could about Wisconsin agriculture. When I originally started college, I thought I was going to be a large animal veterinarian. I thought that was the best way to work with cows for the rest of my life. But throughout college, I actually got to meet Alice in Dairyland for the first time at the Wisconsin State Fair and seeing how she was able to connect with consumers and share that story that I wanted to hear growing up, I felt was so important. And I went back to college that fall and I switched my major from dairy science to life sciences communications in order to pursue becoming Alice. And I just want to say I believe Alices and passionate people and farmers can come from anywhere, whether you're an eighth generation growing up on a farm or you have never milked a cow in your life. Like, you can get involved in agriculture at any age. And I hope that I stand as a testament to that. And being passionate about agriculture doesn't always mean, oh, I need to go be a farmer now. If that's something you're passionate about, it's something I care a lot about. And so I own my own livestock now. But being passionate about agriculture can mean paying attention to where our food is coming from in the grocery store or visiting farmers markets to talk to food producers directly. So there's a lot of different ways to get involved and be passionate about agriculture that doesn't necessarily mean being a farmer. And there's actually 1 in 9 jobs in Wisconsin relate back to the agriculture industry. And 2/3 of those jobs are in agricultural processing. So that wouldn't be on a farm. And some people who might not identify as agriculturalists actually do work in the agriculture industry.
That's really interesting. And like you mentioned, you were crowned as Alice in Dairyland earlier this summer. Mm-hmm. What are you most excited about accomplishing during your tenure as Alice?
I am really excited to kind of spread the word of Alice. I feel like she's continuing to get bigger and bigger. We're gaining a lot of momentum and a lot of traction. Just watching Ashley last year as she kind of built our social media presence larger than it's been before. And I feel like bringing Alice more and more to those urban audiences is something that's really important to me. I want everyone to be able to identify with Alice, not just our farmer audiences.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I don't think a lot of people realize the amount of work that goes into being Alice. You mentioned a little bit about the social media part, but can you tell me what an average work week looks like for you?
Yeah, so I'm doing quite a few things. Sometimes I get lucky and I have a day off during the week, and sometimes I'm working 7 days a week, just like our farmers are. It really ranges depending on the season. So sometimes if I'm doing a marketing campaign, I will be on TV or on the radio 5 or 6 times, maybe 7, 8, 9, 10 times in a week, depending on what the campaign is. We're looking forward to our holiday campaign right now, so I know I'll be on the road a lot for that. And then in the afternoons, I'm normally visiting lots of events. Sometimes I'm a keynote speaker. Sometimes I'm just there to learn. And then some days I'm out on the farm learning, you know, whether it's to be a cranberry producer or a potato grower or a dairy farmer for a day and kind of seeing how all of the different farms across Wisconsin work. And then I get to go on social media and teach other people about what a day in the life of a cranberry producer looks like. And so it's a lot of fun. I get to do something different every single day. Some days I have one thing on the schedule and some days I have 4 things that are all the way across the state from each other. I think my busiest day, I went from Madison to Juneau County Fair and then back across to the eastern side of the state to Dodge County Fair and then up north to Kewaunee for a farm-to-table dinner. And then I went back down to Madison at the end of the day. And I know that's like not even nearly as crazy as it gets. But it is a lot of fun. It's a lot of work, but I like to say I have the best day every day, and it only gets better because I love getting to meet new people along the way.
Yeah, I mean, there are only so many hours in a day, so I do not know how you're doing that.
I swear, sometimes it's like I time travel. I was just in classrooms earlier this week, and one of the students raised their hand. They're like, well, how fast do you have to drive to get to all those places? I said, well, exactly the speed limit.
Oh my God, love that. So I guess it makes me wonder, like, how many miles will you have driven by the end of your term?
Based on how much I've been driving the first 2 months, I'm projected to do about 70,000 miles. But in reality, it's probably going to be closer to 50,000. It really depends. Like State Fair, I was at State Fair for 11 days. So I wasn't really driving at all. And then some weeks I'm all over the place, up to Rhinelander, down to Madison and Beloit, you know, back up to River Falls. And so it really depends on the week, but about 50,000 by the time I'm done.
Wow. And do you like drive like a special car around the state or?
Yes. So I drive a Ford Explorer. If you see her, you will know. She says Allison Dairyland right on the side. There's corn all over her. That's because she's furnished by the Wisconsin Corn Board and she's fueled by Wisconsin ethanol.
Oh, nice. So it runs on ethanol.
Yes. So she runs on Wisconsin corn.
Oh my God. I love how it's all Wisconsin.
Yep. It's all wrapped up together. And it is really fun going down the highway because sometimes you'll see people get like whiplash. Like they're, oh my gosh, what was that? And sometimes people know who Alice is and they're waving, they're excited. People honk at you sometimes. So it's a lot of fun.
Oh, that's really neat. So when you're giving a presentation or a speech, what's a big takeaway you hope people come away with or know about Wisconsin's agriculture industry?
So going back to what I said earlier, I feel like I lap myself a lot, but it's so important that Wisconsin agriculture is for everyone. And one of the questions I ask in classrooms is, how are you connected to agriculture? And I'll sometimes get students raise their hand and say, well, I'm not. I'm not at all connected to agriculture. My family doesn't work on a farm. I've never seen a cow. I like to say there's three ways that we're connected to agriculture every single day. We eat every day. We wear clothes, which sometimes are cotton or wool, and those are agricultural products. And, you know, whether we drive or our moms or dads drive or taking the bus, cars are fueled by ethanol, which is corn. And so those are just three ways that we're connected, the food, fiber, and fuel products every single day to Wisconsin agriculture. But there's so many other ways to get involved. And like I said, it's not always working on a farm. There are just so many ways to get involved with agriculture, and I think that's the most important message I have to spread.
Yeah, and again, I know you just started 2 months ago, but kind of looking ahead, what do you hope to do after Alice in Dairyland? Do you think you'll want to continue working within the agriculture industry?
110%, like 1,000%, yes. I don't quite know what yet. I'm putting my whole heart and soul into Alice right now. And Alice is a dream job for me. I feel like it hits every single one of the boxes that I wanted to do when I graduated college. I get to be a communicator and an educator, and I get to see animals and work with people and work with agriculture. It is the best job in the whole world, at least in my opinion. And once I'm done being Alice, I know that I'll continue telling the story of Wisconsin agriculture and our rural Americans. And I think that that is also the best job in the whole world.
And before we wrap up, you know, the Alice in Dairyland program started 77 years ago in 1948. Why is it important to keep this tradition going?
Alice has changed a lot over the last 77 years, and I think that she has changed absolutely for the better. She meets the needs of a changing Wisconsin. You know, we believe in the Wisconsin idea, keep moving forward. And as we continue to change as a state and our agriculture innovates and develops, Alice will continue to change with the times. And I'm really excited to see where the program goes in the future. It's kind of hard right now to, you know, I'm in it right now and I'm thinking, okay, well, I have this marketing campaign and I have this coming up and this. But I'm excited to see Alice continue to grow. Right now, we're at about 17,000 followers on Facebook and 3,000 followers on Instagram. And we're just waiting for that one, you know, viral post to really kick us off. And I'm really excited to see going forward because agriculture will always be around. It might look different, you know, hydroponics is new, drones are new, well, relatively new. So Alice has to change to meet those needs of Wisconsin, and we will always need somebody to talk about those changes to agriculture in Wisconsin.
Absolutely. Well, Haley, thank you so much for speaking with me today and telling me more about really the great work that you're doing across our state.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Haley Heinzel is Wisconsin's 77th Alice in Dairyland. She spoke with Lake Effect's Excrete Nunez. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. People who enjoy camping know that gearing up can be expensive. Coming up next, we'll visit the MKE Outdoor-Indoor Exchange to learn how they're working to bring down costs and prevent waste. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Reduce, reuse, repair. Those three words are central to the mission of the MKE Outdoor-Indoor Exchange Shop in Bayview. It specializes in making outdoor gear more affordable and accessible while prioritizing sustainability. They buy, sell, rent, and repair everything from hiking and biking equipment to camping and travel gear. It was founded by John Cameron, who was inspired by other gear exchanges he's seen out of state. Cameron sees his shop as a way to make a circular economy in Milwaukee and beyond. To learn more, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski visited Cameron at the shop.
When were you becoming more aware of the secondhand market and, you know, what made you want to be a part of it yourself as a business owner?
I've always kind of tried to live off the bottom of the world. Like, I don't think that I need to consume much, and I think that I've lived pretty large as far as living off the bottom goes. So I've always kind of tried to live without consuming, and I see that that's growing culturally, so I'm trying to just kind of contribute to it. But I've been a reseller most of my adult life, probably just from, you know, not having much money from whatever job you're doing at the time.
Do you think the view and perspective of buying secondhand, you know, I think a lot of people are familiar with thrift stores and that model, right? But what you have here is a little something different. Do you think in today's shopping market and changes of perspective that people are becoming more open and willing to participate?
I would say so. I'd say that there's still always going to be a cringe factor to used for whatever reason, you know, for whatever culture of people there are, but, you know, statistically, like, I think that there's a huge margin of people that are happy to, like, not consume, not pollute by using new products, and are tapped into the truth of it, and you know, and where their clothes really come from. So I think there's a lot of truths that people don't know that are the people that are also cringing at it. So.
Yeah, well, there's this concept and a term called embodied energy. Can you explain this and how it shapes your business?
Yeah, so everything I think about in life, I feel like kind of comes back to embodied energy. I think that, like, you know, it took this shirt, 2 boats, 4 factories, like 600 gallons of water, a bunch of pollution and dye out the backside of the factory. It took a cotton field to make it. It took, you know, synthetic fibers to weave it together. All those things and places and the origin of them add up to the embodied energy of the shirt that I'm wearing right now. So if we can alleviate all those processes by just using new or secondhand or repurposing things, those numbers are huge. They're giant.
So pivoting from an inspector in the corporate world to outdoor gear shop, what's your connection to the outdoors? Why did you want to focus on this for your first business venture?
So that's kind of funny, especially framed with the corporate interest first. When I was 15, I met some punk rockers that were riding trains, and I just wanted to be like them, so I did it. And I went to Key West on a one-way ticket, and I've slept in 48 out of the 50 states at least one or more nights doing that. So whether it was by thumb, by boot, or by rail, that's kind of how I got around our country.
So your experience hitchhiking around the country with, I'm sure, whatever gear you could find to now helping people with some proper gear, yeah?
I have definitely tested some gear, a lot of different gear, all the different cook stoves. I've had so many different sleeping pads. I've had failures. I've had things that just lasted way too long that I'm ultimately impressed with, you know, yeah. So I don't share that all the time because it's not a focus of like outdoor hiking kind of health culture, but that is my experience. I slept on the ground a whole ton, a whole bunch.
So your model for this store, you buy, sell, consign, rent, and repair outdoor gear. So I want to break this down a little bit for any listeners who are unfamiliar, specifically about consignment. So I see some price tags around us, and they have certain dates with different pricing. So can you explain how consignment works?
Yeah, so with our system here, we do a 120-day period, and every 30 days, the item drops 10, 25, 50%. And then at the end of that period, it expires. So, you know, that gives it a good run at a few different price points. The focus is always used, but you're going to find a lot of newer tags that are used. So we reach out to brands directly. I'm not going to list them because we're on the radio right now, but directly with brands. And the brands have been really reaching back to my business model and appreciating what I do. And my thing right now on a whole like kind of vision is I'm cleaning up the gear industry. I'm cleaning up the perimeter of the gear industry. There's a lot of overflow. There's a lot of excess. There's a lot of overproduction. And I'm just reaching out and grabbing that overproduction, that stuff that's new with tags, that beautiful, crispy garment, and then bringing it to you at a reduced price. Then we can take it down to even the local vintage hunter that goes out and they go to the thrift store and they dig through everything and then they bring me in garments. And then there's people who just simply are cleaning out their house or are serious athletes and have closets full of stuff. It's endless, the resources.
So remind me when you first opened this business.
August 1st, 2022.
All right. So being in it a little bit, can you talk about your mindset when you first dove in with both feet, you know, changing careers, starting a business? Entrepreneurship is a scary and challenging thing. What was going through your head?
I am a cancer survivor and I could not do my old job. I could not physically do my old job. And then I also was no longer able to have my old job because I had cancer for too long, you know, termination through corporate, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, I was crazy. I was absolutely crazy to do this, to start a retail store, and especially a cringy used consignment shop, you know, in a state that's never even had a gear exchange. So they don't even know what I'm doing. It's definitely a little fringe. And I just think that I had faith in people wanting to recycle. And I just think that I had faith it would work. And, you know, I'm still sitting on faith. I'm definitely not sitting on a mountain of cash. So, like, I'm looking forward to, I feel the traction right now. I feel the growth. There's a lot of room to grow. And there's a lot more products out there that I can continue to get.
Can you talk about some of the challenges or learning curves that stick out to you most? I'm sure there are plenty of examples, but does one story stick out in your brain?
Yeah, overbuying stuff that just doesn't fit. I've bought shopping carts and shopping carts of stuff that doesn't fit the store. And it's, you know what, it's good. Just donate it to the homeless and move on, you know, but that's a lot of money. And also I touched base with Amazon for a minute. That was a total disastrous mistake. That was kind of before I got the business. It raised the money for this business, but then it also took a lot of money out of this business when it crashed. And then, you know, I don't know. I think sometimes it's just hard with people, you know, dealing with the would or would not be people who would want to help you or work with you. And, you know, are their interests in line with yours? That's always a thing because this isn't like a job at the local Target. Like, you need to care if you're going to stick it out here. And so, like, it's good. Yeah, no, things are positive. I just think that, you know, like, it's hard to see what's in front of you until you're standing there 2 years later, and luckily I'm still standing here, so.
You mentioned you are a cancer survivor, and if you're okay with talking a little more about it, absolutely fine if not, but going through that experience, and I'm sure all of the challenges and the scary moments of going through treatment and coming out the other side, you know, not that it essentially makes you more of a risk taker, but does it help you view things differently in taking chances on yourself and your shop?
I would have never done this. I would have never had the option to take this risk. This isn't going to get me rich in the first year, and I'm already 40 years old, you know. I spent my 401k on this, and that was brave in its own self. It was the only money I had, and it was like the only option. I couldn't work. I still, you know, I still haven't eaten this morning because I can't eat a half a stomach. It's just what it is. So I just kind of power through this stuff and get in what I can. And so this job's pretty much mandatory for me for a little while at least.
What kind of fulfillment does it give you, to have this space and to see your work come to fruition, but being your own boss, being able to work with what's best for you and your life and your needs?
It's really good. It's, you know, I really hope that my daughter and son get to see me be my own boss as they grow. But I've never been good at having a boss, and corporate, I was the square peg for sure. And so the best thing about working here, though, is like you get to come in here with your like goals and your like wants and needs. The thing you save all your money to go do, you're like, I'm going to the Grand Canyon tomorrow, or I'm going to Belize, or I'm going to Guam, or wherever you're going. You've worked really hard to get there. And I get to like basically listen to how excited you are, help you with a couple things that are going to help you along the way, high five you, and then send you on that trip. And that is freaking cool because I get to see the best part of people. You're here to buy something special for the like one of the most memorable parts of your life, and that's fulfilling.
On that note, sometimes outdoor stores and the general culture of outdoorsiness, right, can feel exclusive or intimidating for some people who aren't familiar or diving in.
Absolutely.
And, you know, also just not financially intimidating or accessible, but culturally as well. And it can be a little unwelcoming to outsiders, or people might feel reticent to walk into a space they're not normally in. So how are you working to make this space welcoming and accessible?
The only people I make uncomfortable are the elitists. I try to make sure you know if you're a glamper, a camper, an RVer, a hiker, a hobo, I don't care. You're welcome here because, you know, there's only two places. There's outdoors and indoors. And if anyone wants to go and stake claim on it, you know, you can take their white flag and throw it in the river. That is not acceptable. You know, I think a large thing in society is people making up fake barriers to entry. And, there are no barriers to entry besides the front door of your house on the outdoor world. So, like, now let me step back. If you're going to go climbing and you don't know how to climb and you fall and you hurt someone, yo, that's kind of your fault. And there's a lot of things that do deserve a barrier to entry. So let me not be too light on that when it comes to the safety and well-being of our clients and our people out there in the wild doing wild stuff. But at the end of the day, you know, like, if you're not wearing a Patagonia jacket and someone wants to give you guff for not wearing a Patagonia or not wearing a Canadian Goose, that person's a problem. You are definitely not the problem. You're welcome to be here. And, you know, if they were in here acting like that, I would make sure that they feel that same kind of whatever they're doing to people. It's not comfortable. And, you know, it's not theirs to take away from you. So
I also noticed that you often promote other people, other companies, and bringing them in and collaborating. I first met you at the Indoor Outdoor Gala that you held. So is this part of your personal philosophy or role that you see for yourself as a business owner in the community?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I grew up on punk rock music, and I think one of the words that really stick out over time is unity. And that's a culture that, like, you know, don't die easy is unify people. And so the gala is a good example of, like, what my philosophy is. I invited everyone here for free, even my competitors. The whole point is to provide a better outdoor experience for the people. And so if we gather ourselves together as retailers and guides and everything, and we know each other by first name and we know each other by their family and our friends and our products, then we're going to be a lot better at referring each other and sharing. You know, like my friend just started a business called Forward Outdoor, and I'm really looking forward to watching him blow up because he has got the right mindset. And so supporting people like that, it's a pleasure and it's absolutely free. And, you know, we do a lot of clothing drives and stuff like that. We only talk about half of the stuff we're donating because we're not trying to milk it at all. But, like, it's strange to me when people don't give back because it's so easy. I'm running this thing on a shoestring budget. I got two kids. I don't sleep. And I still can throw you guys a block party for absolutely nothing.
I like that philosophy. You talked a bit about your biggest joys and takeaways from starting and running Milwaukee Outdoor Indoor Exchange. What are your hopes for the long run, or do you take it more short term?
No, I want to be old. I want to be in here with big ears and big old hair coming out of my ears, wearing overalls, all having the same kind of attitude. Like, I want my kids in here if they want to be here, and if not, you know, that's what it is. But I hope that this is my last job. You know, if we could blow this thing up and have 3-5 locations, I could eat for the rest of my life on 3-5 locations and everyone else would benefit. You know, we've already brought over last year $60,000 worth of consignment out of basements, attics, and, you know, yards, so on. So, like, if we're generating that kind of revenue, that's 120 total if you, you know, count my half, out of basements and yards. So, like, if we can do that on a constant, well, I think we're a solution to pollution as far as that kind of stuff goes.
Well, John, I want to thank you for welcoming me here today and for sharing your story. I truly appreciate it.
I'm flattered. Thank you so much for showing up and, you know, documenting our journey.
John Cameron is the owner of the MKE Outdoor-Indoor Exchange in Bayview. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski at the shop. And you can find pictures and more information at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear from some undecided Wisconsin voters. That's tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.